Life,
a podcast of the cinema,
featuring Alonzo Duralde, who is sitting right across from me. He is my husband. He is a film critic for TheWrap.com. He's actually the film reviews editor for TheWrap.com, so he's more important than just any old film critic. I'm just any old film critic.
And you're Dave White.
Yeah.
And you write for The Wrap.
Yeah, and you're my editor. So there's a hierarchy. And the, in most places, terms of film criticism,
I'm whatever.
Yeah. I don't think that way of you.
Thank you.
You also host
other
podcasts, Breakfast All Day, Maximum Film, sometimes Deck the Hallmark, other things. I don't know. You're going to be on CNN this Friday.
Yes.
This Christmas Eve.
That's true. And on Jake Tapper, whenever that airs, 4 to 6 Eastern, I think, somewhere in there.
I don't really know anything about Jake Tapper. I don't know anything about CNN.
Yeah, me
quite
neither,
frankly.
Really.
I know you were on that movies special documentary they did a couple years ago.
The Movies, yes.
Called The Movies, right, exactly. This is your month to be all over the place on cable television because, A, you're going to be on this Jake Tapper situation on Friday. And then also there is the TCM special called A Night at the Movies.
Well, that was already on.
Merry Christmas. And it's already aired, but I think they might air it again.
I think it's done.
Is it now? But it's on their streaming thing?
It might
too,
be on the app. I haven't looked. Yeah.
And then somebody just said they saw you on the History Channel.
The real
story of Christmas. That was recorded about 10 years ago, too. Listen, if you see him pop up on pay cable, regular basic cable, you'll notice that his hair...
If my hair is still brown, it means they did it like a decade ago.
It is a very dark brown hair he used to have, and now it's snowy white. Santa Claus.
This will be the last time of the year that I promote the fact that I'm also the co-author of I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies, a great last-minute gift. If you need a last-minute gift, it's available in bookstores everywhere.
It'll arrive too late.
Not if you go to a physical bookstore
to buy it. Should you go into a real bookstore, though, right now?
Well, that's up to the individual.
You're
going to
get that
to
on the ground. You go to a real bookstore right now. That's what's going to happen. Everyone, stay home, please.
Stay home. This is turning into the thing of, like, I don't wash my car because it'll rain. I feel like if I start tiptoeing out in the world again and thinking like
a new variant will,
I can venture
smack
forward.
You down.
Yes, exactly. This cycle has gotten really depressing.
Listen, sucks out there.
Yeah.
On a scale of 1 to 10,
it sucks.
How exhausted and beaten down are you?
Depends on when you ask me.
And yet. We're going to have a lovely little Christmas.
Sure.
Here in our home.
Yes.
With no one coming over.
Correct.
And us eating all the food.
Sure. As it should be.
I'm going to wrap up that porchetta tomorrow.
Very excited about
that. Are you ready?
Can I be?
Are you ready?
Could I be ready?
I decided I wanted to make a porchetta for Christmas Eve because there was going to be no one around. So I went to two different destinations.
Mm-hmm.
We watched, back when Matty Matheson had his Viceland show called It's Supper Time.
That's ever since then, I've been like, when are we having a porchetta?
He made one on that show, and you can still see the clip on YouTube, but it's always been like, I'm going to do this. Never got around to it. But then a couple weeks ago, I would say the polar opposite of Matty Matheson, J. Kenji Lopez-Alt,
mm-hmm.
who is precise and thoughtful and nerdy and, Not the wild maniac that Matty Matheson is.
Right.
He posted a porchetta recipe a while back that does not involve the pork loin, just the belly. You just get pork belly and roll it up. And he espousing the virtues of this pork belly only porchetta in that it stays really fatty and juicy all the way through and every slice is the same.
Ooh.
No worries about the middle part, the loin, mm-hmm. being dry or overcooked. And I thought, okay, well, I'm a dummy and I'm not good at this, so why don't I just do it the easy way? So
you are good at this, but as you wish.
I had a pork belly. Well, I've never made porchetta, so I don't know if I'm good at it.
True.
All right. So I got a pork belly delivered to our door.
You took the bagpipes out.
Don't you wish there was no Omicron variant? You might be allowed to come over and join us for this eaten experience. But unfortunately, there is and you cannot. So we'll report back later. Maybe yes. Not on this show, but definitely on a Linoleum Knife and Fork.
Absolutely.
We'll let y'all know if it turned out nicely.
Speaking of Linoleum Knife and Fork, we have a Patreon page at patreon.com/linoleumknife. But as our holiday gift to you,
next week, a bunch of shows that would normally be behind the Patreon paywall of subscription
are going to go out on our...
they're dropping for everybody.
Our RSS feed. So yes, even if you are not a Patreon subscriber, you will get a little taste of
yes.
many pleasures of our additional content.
And what you'll learn during that week is that, do you really want to hear us every single day? Maybe no. Maybe yes. But
maybe yes. That's the magic of it all. Because if no, then no one's making you.
You know what I'm going to make you do right now?
What's that?
Review the current cinema.
Ah, fine.
And then we're going to be done with this show and we're going to eat some dinner and relax.
Great.
It's late in the afternoon.
Yes, I'm genuinely excited about that.
The house painters that have been climbing all over the roof and walls of this apartment building seem to have gone home for the day.
Yes.
Because I'm not hearing the clompity clomp. Above our heads, the scrapity scrape on the
Spider-Man turn off the dark that's doing our building.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about these films in alphabetical order.
Oh.
Pretty methodical about it this
morning. Okay.
I've seen most of them. You've seen all of them.
Okay.
Yeah. Drive My Car.
Mm. Winner of the New York Film Critics Circle and Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Best Picture of 2021.
It's the new film from Ryusuke Hamaguchi.
Yes.
Now, earlier this year, he's had two films get released in the U.S. this year.
Yes.
Earlier this year, Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy mm-hmm. was released. Neither one of us has seen that yet.
No. Nor have we seen Asako 1 and 2, which was his film from last year.
But we did see Happy Hour.
Yes.
And you might remember us talking about Happy Hour a couple years back.
We watched it one Super Bowl Sunday.
Yes. It's a five-hour film mm-hmm. about a friendship between four women in Japan. And it was such an incredible movie that... I can't quite figure out how we haven't yet seen Asako 1 and 2 or Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy. We're going to get to them.
Well, there's been things happening.
Things have happened. There was this pandemic.
Yes.
Yeah. But we saw this one.
Mm-hmm.
It is based on a Haruki Murakami short story.
Yes.
Adapted from that. Stars... Hidetoshi Nishijima as a stage actor and director who is married to a woman who is a television screenwriter. And they have what is by all, you know, appearances
yes.
a lovely relationship. And he is clearly deeply, you know, in love with her. They've been together for over 20 years. Early in their relationship, they lost a child, like 4 or 5 year old child. They stuck it through, and they're still together. One day he comes home and sees her having sex with a TV actor that she had introduced to him earlier.
Backstage at a performance of Waiting for Godot that he was in.
Yeah. He quietly backs out of their house. They don't notice him walk in. And he never speaks to her about it. He just knows that it happened. Not long after this, he comes home again, and she's dead on the floor.
Yes.
She has had a cerebral hemorrhage.
Yeah.
Cut to a couple years later, and he is still grieving her loss. And he has been assigned to direct a production of Uncle Vanya in a nearby
in
city.
Hiroshima.
Oh, it's in Hiroshima. That's correct. Yes. Thank you. Forgot that part. He gets to the production. He begins auditioning people, but one of the things that he is told when he gets there is that they have a rule that all visiting
artists
have to have a driver. He does not want to have a driver. He loves to drive his own car. And one of the reasons he loves to drive his own car is because he has a cassette tape in it. It's an old Saab 9000. He has a cassette tape in there with his late wife's voice on it. She reads all the dialogue from Uncle Vanya, except the part of Uncle Vanya, and he fills in the blanks as he's driving.
It's how he would learn his lines when he was an actor.
This is comforting to him. I won't say it's therapeutic, but it's comforting to him. And he's kind of stuck in that practice.
Yes.
But the insurance rules are the insurance rules, and they assign a driver to him, a woman named Misaki. And that she's played by Toko Miura. And she is a very efficient driver. She's a very smooth driver. She knows how to handle the car well. She doesn't talk. She just kind of looks at him a lot. He says, look, I want to do this thing with the cassette. Are you okay, you know, with that? She's like, yeah, sure, whatever. But she goes with him everywhere. And the auditions come along in the process of this play being mounted, and who should show up but this young TV actor with whom his wife had been
involved.
If not having an affair, at least just having sex.
Right.
And the relationship between the young actor and
the director.
Yusuke is his name. The director's name is Yusuke. It becomes weird because the young actor is going to play Uncle Vanya.
Yes.
How much of this movie do we think running time? It's a 3-hour film.
Yeah.
How much of it takes place inside the cabin of a car? A lot.
Quite a bit of it.
Like,
yeah.
Like 50% of the movie, right?
Yeah. There's one very long trip happens toward the end of the mm-hmm. film after the director and the driver get to know each other better and she begins to reveal some details about her own past.
Right.
The credits of the film don't pop up for 45 minutes. It basically kind of treats the whole beginning of the film as the prologue to the rest of the story.
Yeah.
So it's not until he's like it headed to Hiroshima or in Hiroshima
that you see the actual
suddenly the credits
the
start.
Film.
You're like, yeah. Oh wait, oh we're doing
that's
this
some,
now.
That's okay. Some Godardian stuff right yeah. there.
But it does sort of like let you know that this how this film's structure is being set up and you know what we've already seen versus what we're about to see.
You and I agree that we love this film.
Yes.
Tell me why you love it.
You know, it's a well, first of all, it's a great film about process.
Mm-hmm.
About the way that this guy directs, the way he is putting together this show, and the way that he how he treats his actors and what he asks of them reflects so much of his own inner struggles.
Right.
And his own inner turmoil. So I found that fascinating. I love the sort of elliptical nature of how much isn't expressed out loud, but you are gleaning from glances and from context clues and other things like that.
Small comments about unrelated stuff.
Exactly.
Seemingly unrelated
yeah.
stuff.
You know, one of the things that I loved about Happy Hour was how much it delved into how much you can learn about people's selves through these seemingly mundane moments of daily life. And yeah, this movie, just in the way of how he interacts with people, how sort of closed off he is to certain things and yet how receptive he is to other things. I feel like there's so much that's being revealed about character in a non-traditional way that I just found really gripping.
I agree. This reminds me of Happy Hour in many ways, in the way that but specifically in the way that he deals with characters. He observes them. He doesn't push you. He doesn't push them.
Right.
If you're sort of balking at the idea of a long movie that's 3 hours or 5 hours, you know, think of it like a miniseries then.
Sure.
You know, watch it that way if you must. Because you're going to get the same effect. And you're going to come away having, you know, immersed yourself in his observance of these characters. It's a very quiet movie. The tension between the director and the actor, between Yusuke and the actor's name is Koji, the tension between them never really spills over into what you think it might.
Right. There's never the kind of confrontation you think that the movie might be building toward.
But off screen, you know that stuff is building to a head.
Yes.
And for me, it's even less about those two and their complicated, you know, fraught relationship where neither one of them knows exactly what the other knows.
Right.
You know? They're dancing around this idea of, yes, you loved your wife, and I also loved your wife.
Right.
But you had such a much more deep thing with her that I'm here to kind of like leech it out of you if I can.
Yeah.
The
closest I can get to being with her is
to just
spending time with you.
Yeah. More important to me, anyway, in the length of the film is the relationship between
him and the driver,
between the director and the driver, and as she slowly reveals her own sense of grief and loss and guilt about the death of her mother, and he begins to unfold about his ex-wife, his late wife,
right.
Again, without it ever becoming sentimental, it's this very powerful examination of what do you do when someone close to you is gone and there's unresolved stuff.
Right.
You know, how do you process your role in their life? And what if you feel guilt that you don't deserve to feel?
Mm-hmm.
What if you feel, you know, like there's unanswered questions with how they felt about you? On another level, I think it's also about the role of art.
Yes.
In people's lives.
In healing.
I mean, it's not that I think this. It is this. Yeah. If you're paying attention to the movie, it is. One of the things the director says to the actors in Uncle Vanya is when they're responding to each other as actors,
mm-hmm.
he wants them to stop doing that. And at first you think he's being very sort of Bressanian about it. They're like, he says, let's just read the text.
Yeah. It's all in the text.
Just read the text. Stop acting with each other. Stop. Just read the text. And he, at one point he says, you know, respond to it rather than each other. So he's saying this to the actors, but the film is kind of saying it to you, the viewer, as well. Because that's what a critic is supposed to do, but that's also what an audience member is supposed to do. A non-critic viewer. A film is a text.
Yeah.
And it can be mere entertainment. I think the best films are more than that. And if you can walk out of a movie and immediately forget about it, then I don't think that movie did much of its job.
Right.
So you are in life, if you are engaged with film, you're meant to respond to it. You carry it with you.
Yes.
And you learn from it. You have an emotional response, maybe at least, or an intellectual response, or a physical response.
Yeah.
When you're really young, you might imprint really hard on a movie, which is why we can often carry bad films with us into adulthood and feel very fond affection for it. But they can also be, you know, good to great films that you imprint on young, and they teach you not just about life, but about how to look at art.
Right.
How to read a book, how to watch a movie, how to watch a TV show, how to listen to a piece of music. You are meant to take this stuff with you through your life and learn how to live from it. It ain't like your parents are doing such a great job. Perhaps I'm just speaking to myself here. But that's also what this film is about.
Yeah.
I love this movie. I would love to watch it again. I saw it on an awards screener.
Yeah.
Would love to see it on a big screen.
That would be nice.
Someday.
In the meantime, if folks are interested in checking out Happy Hour, it's currently streaming on the Criterion Channel.
Oh, nice.
And
Drive My Car is currently in theaters.
In theaters, yeah. Yes. It just got shortlisted this week for the Oscar for Best International Film.
Nice.
Titan did not, but...
here's the thing about Titan.
Yeah.
Academy voters...
Yeah, it's a little much for them, I think.
...are going to look at Titan and go, oh, no, 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 no. It's a lot. It's a lot.
They also did not shortlist Memoria, but again, that's not for everybody.
We're going to be talking about Memoria here in just a moment. A film like Memoria, the whole like, well, are awards bodies going to be able to see Memoria? And I thought to myself, what do you care? Don't matter.
They're not going to be falling all over themselves.
Right.
For this one.
All right, let's talk about The Matrix.
Okay.
The Matrix Resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
This is not...
Resurrections.
Resurrections. This is not by the Wachowskis. This is by one Wachowski.
Yes.
Lana.
Yes.
Lily is having a vacation.
Lily did that Showtime show.
Oh, I don't know what Lily's doing.
No, she was really quoted as being like, this, the thought of going back and doing more Matrix depressed her, apparently.
Right.
Yes. I get it. I don't get the feeling that Lana was super excited about it herself now that I've seen the movie, but...
Here's what I think, before we get into it. In spite of, you know, the things that the film says at the beginning, I think are fairly, tongue-in-cheek about... There's an exchange of dialogue at the beginning of the film where people are talking about how they want Keanu, who is, you know, Mr. Anderson / Neo, who is in reality a video game designer.
Or in the Matrix, rather.
In the Matrix or out of the Matrix, he's a video game designer. They're like, your game was called The Matrix, and we want a sequel to the trilogy. And he's like, no.
No, well, then what they say is, Warner Brothers wants a fourth one, and they'll go ahead and do it without us if we don't do it.
Right. And so, sure, did that happen in real life with Lana and Lily Wachowski? Did Warner Brothers say, we're doing this movie? We own this.
Yeah. Well, and you like it, we're doing it with you or without you.
You can be on board, or you can... go do whatever else you want, but if you want to have any kind of determination over what happens, you're going to... Now, I don't know if that conversation happened, but it happens in the film, which suggests to me that, yeah, maybe Lana said, you know what? All right, if you're going to push me, I'll do it, but we're going to do it my way.
My way.
And her way is the wild way. Her way... is the messy, weirdo way. Her way is the queer way. Her way is the, extravagant everything all at once at the same time way. I mean, you saw Speed Racer. Yeah.
Jupiter Ascending was not made by minimalists.
Jupiter Ascending? Yeah, you saw Cloud Atlas. Lana Wachowski is not someone to come at it half way.
Yeah.
So I think that if Warner Brothers had their way and, you know, pushed her out of it, you would have a very staid action film here. And it would probably appeal to exactly all the wrong people who took all the wrong messages from that film in the 90s, and ran with them and became men's rights activists.
Right.
And started talking about the red pill as though it were the clear-eyed masculinist guide to life.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So here's this new movie. Keanu's a game designer. And he works with a company full of jerks. And he is pulled back into the double reality of the Matrix by a young person named Bugs, played by Jessica Henwick from Game of Thrones and, you know, The Force Awakens, and she's in a bunch of stuff.
Gotcha.
She's got the White Rabbit tattoo on her arm, you know, and they're playing that song, and she's reading Alice in Wonderland, and, you know, it's like that whole,
get it?
I am your guide. Here we go. There is this, you know, war inside Anderson / Neo's mind. What's real? What's not? Where am I? Who am I? Is the life I think I'm living the real one, or is the Matrix the real thing?
He's seeing a therapist who keeps giving him blue pills.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, the pills are completely different now. There have been many advancements in screen pill design. Back in the day, they looked like NyQuil capsules. Yeah, for all we know,
contact.
That's what they were. No. They were like little like gel caps.
No, they had like the Valley of the Dolls. Like, oh no, you're right. They did look like gel caps.
Yes, I am right.
Sorry, I take that back.
But now they look like little metallic.
They're foil or something.
They're beautiful.
Yeah.
If you handed me a bunch of those pills, I'd be like, are they candy? Like I'd be popping them down. And learning so much about myself. and my other realities.
Yes.
What kind of long black PVC coated superhero would I be? Or currently am? In the other world. What is illusion? And what is not?
What is reality anyway?
So, that's about as much as a plot as I care to talk about. Because everything past that is that wild mix of we're here, we're there, we're back, we're forth, we're in two places at once. People are spinning around in the air. Here's a gigantic, sentient, cuddly, manatee-looking machine that wants to be hugged. Here is, you know, Jada Pinkett Smith, old now, in Cloud Atlas makeup. Here's Thelma Hopkins.
Thelma Hopkins. That was the most exciting part of this movie for me.
Blink and you'll miss Christina Ricci.
Yes.
It is a much different world than the original film. And to me, it all comes down to color palette and something the young people like to say, vibe.
Well, I think it's hitting the vibe of 2 and 3.
Right. They were leading here.
Yeah.
So, you know, you used to have this very cold, chill, you know, late 90s, green, blue, the Nine Inch Nails of it all.
Right.
The funny sunglasses situation, that has continued.
There's a whole sunglasses credit in this movie. There's one person that was their entire job was sunglasses.
But as the sequels went on, the color palette warmed up.
Yeah.
And I think now the Wachowskis live in this very corny, hippie-ish world where they've moved on from this. And to bring this franchise into their world is kind of the best way to tell Warner Brothers, you know what, now we're really done. Because if you go back and do anything different after we've brought it forward into 2021, then you will have failed and not us.
I suppose. I don't know. There were just moments here where I could feel not the exhaustion, but just the indifference. You know, I don't know.
Do you think that she is indifferent to this? Or do you think that...
I think that given the choice, she would never think about bullet time again.
Right.
And she would not, like... I think the Wachowskis have, you know, whether or not those films were universally critically beloved or whether or not they were financially successful, they keep going big after very different things.
Yeah.
You know, Jupiter Ascending is not like Cloud Atlas, is not like... Speed Racer,
right?
You know, is not like Sense8. Like right. These are all big, like maybe not hard sci-fi concepts, but certainly like wildly fantastic ones, and certainly with, you know, as you say, a lot of queer subtext, certainly, and other
or just text
or text. Yeah, who are we kidding? Text. And so for them to do a sequel to this, their, you know, greatest hit, or for Lana to come back for a fourth chapter of this.
Yeah.
I'm of two minds. On the one hand, you will come away from this movie with all the sort of Matrix stuff you wanted.
Yeah.
You know, and there are some cool additions. The fact that Neo and Trinity get so much time to just talk to each other because they meet mostly in the Matrix world and not the real world.
Right.
So rather than they spend more time talking in a coffee shop than they do being superheroes. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's a sense of it that feels, if not phoned in, just sort of like, fine here.
No, I can't. I don't agree with you at all. I don't think any of this could be looked at as being phoned in. It's too big and too expansive and too complicated to have been phoned in. So I don't think that's fair. I think that what this movie is at the beginning of it, it's sort of a reckoning with, or at least a commentary on the influence of the first three films on the world.
On the culture, sure. You know,
what it was influenced by, and then what it in turn influenced. You know, it became its own, I hate to use this word, but matrix of cultural signposts. It's about, they touch on what the idea, the narrative of being trans came out of this film and grew in subsequent Wachowski projects. It also has to deal with the fact that the people who misread the film, who took it as their own.
Sure.
And there's a character in the movie who is that guy.
Yes.
Then it moves into this exploration of, you know, challenging binary conceptions of not just the reality as presented in the film, but of the world in general. You know,
the game that Thomas Anderson is working on at the beginning of the movie is called Binary.
Right, right.
Yes, I grant you all that stuff is in there. And I think that maybe if this movie had just been about its own ideas and the philosophies inherent in the franchise, then that would have struck me as a more legitimate thing that Lon Wachowski would have felt driven to make and would have felt like, I really want to explore this. But once we get into the inevitable action-y stuff, which again delivers because she knows what she's doing, she knows how to do this stuff.
Right.
There is this kind of sense of like, I don't know. I just, maybe it's just me, but my read of this film, I just get a sense of like, all right, we're doing this then, I guess. You know, I'm gonna do it hyper competently because I'm one of the modern masters of this.
Right.
But, you know, I have five other scripts in my drawer that I'm far more committed to and excited about, but this is the one that I have to do or else they're going to give it to somebody else.
One of the things, a kind of throwaway line at the beginning, I don't think is a throwaway line. And here's what I think is being attempted here. I think that, well, what someone says at the beginning is, why use old code to mirror something new? Answer, in a practical, logistical way, because she has to. But in that context, she is pushing her own ideas. Like I said, she's extremely eccentric as a filmmaker, in a way that we don't get quite often in the world. Big studio movies like this rarely deal with people like Lana Wachowski, who are demanding to do it exactly as they please. You know, even within the confines of, this is a franchise and we expect big things from this franchise. I feel like they say those things to her and she goes, uh-huh. You know? So, like, what I love about her is that she's unafraid to be that eccentric, to be messy, to be corny, to be a hippie, to be trite, to be too much. And within the confines of what a studio wants, she somehow always manages to get her way. And that's what I like about this. Plus, it's just an enjoyable movie to look at.
Sure. No, no. Yeah. I was entertained more than I wasn't. But I don't know. It just seemed to me inescapably to be this product that was dictated, you know. That's it.
Maybe.
For 2.5 hours.
Let's talk about Memoria.
Yes.
All right.
Which no studio was demanding.
And no studio wants.
Yeah.
Neon got it. Neon took it, and yep, they are going to do whatever it is they feel like doing with it. I wish I knew what that was right now.
Yeah, they're doing if you know about this movie, quite possibly you know it is that movie with Tilda Swinton that's playing one city at a time forever.
Right. If you've been listening to this podcast very long, you know that one of my favorite living filmmakers is Thai director Pichot Phong Wirasuthukon. sometimes known as Joe.
A.K.A. the Uncle Boonmi guy.
Uncle Boonmi, who can recall his past lives, tropical malady, syndromes in a century,
Cemetery of Splendor,
Blissfully Yours.
Did we ever talk on this show about that anthology film that he was a part of this year?
The Year of the Everlasting Storm?
Yes.
We have not talked about that yet.
And did you see it? Because I have not.
It's in the Neon screener.
Oh, we haven't. Okay.
We'll watch it. We just haven't watched it.
Okay.
I love his films so much that it's occasionally a running joke on this podcast. I cannot lay claim to understanding everything that he puts on screen. But the feeling that it gives me is one that I crave. Because he slows down my heart rate. And apparently, I'm not alone in this. People report frequently just falling asleep.
I do.
In his movies.
It's happened to me on more than one occasion.
So much so.
The Calm app of cinema sometimes.
So much so that he did a museum exhibit about sleep. And you were encouraged to come to the installation and recline and watch and doze and wake up. And I don't know, I love that idea.
Well, I mean, there are times where he's all but daring you. I mean, in Cemetery of Splendor, where you are watching characters watch a room full of people sleeping.
Yeah.
People, yeah. And they're doing these like lights to like help them sleep deeper.
Yeah, I
figured, look, I'm interacting with this film by having a quick nod off here.
Okay, so here's the weird release pattern of this movie. It opens December 26th in New York for 1 week at, I think, Film Forum. And then Neon is taking it on the road, one city, one theater at a time. I don't know where it's going after New York, because every few days I go to the internet to look for what the schedule is of its next stop, and nobody seems to feel like updating that information.
I'm wondering if they are hedging their bets in terms of like, okay, well, if we pack him in for a week, you know, then maybe we extend our run and maybe it's not at the Film Forum. Maybe we go to the Angelica or somewhere else.
I don't know.
Maybe they just like hit a city and stay in that city until the city's done.
You know? I don't know. All I know is that the mysterious nature of this film is mirrored in the mysterious nature of its release pattern. They say they have no plans to release it on DVD or on any streaming platform.
Right.
That they want to take it from city to city.
Yes.
We, as film critics, we were sent a DVD screener copy. No, you cannot borrow it.
And we are probably...
We would probably be arrested and thrown into jail for letting that happen.
And as soon as we popped it in, we were admonished for even watching it that way.
Yeah. Before and you won't see this when you see it in a movie theater, but it begins with Tilda Swinton and he introduces himself.
And the director.
He introduces himself as Joe Apichatpong.
Yes.
They look right at you and say, "Hello, you are watching a DVD screener. We would prefer that you weren't. We would really love it if you would be in a movie theater right now watching this somehow. But since you're here and you're going to do it like this, please keep in mind that it was not meant to be viewed this way." Now, I don't want to be disrespectful, but I've seen a lot of his films on screens and on TVs. You know, I'm lucky enough to live in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And his films play in movie theaters here. So I'm very fortunate. But sometimes I've seen them on televisions, on DVDs. And if you are an attentive viewer, if you can avoid the distractions of your own home, and it's not that hard to do.
Turn off your other devices.
Turn off your GD phone and turn off the lights and, you know, keep the atmosphere quiet. Because one of the things that you're going to get from a film by Apichatpong Weerasethakul is sounds.
Mm.
He is a sound man. They're making a big deal about the sound design of this film, and they should.
Oh, yeah.
But the sound design of all of his films are like this. They are oral experiences as much as they are visual experiences.
For sure.
So the fact that this movie is about sound, it is about a woman who experiences loud crashing noises in her own head, and those are translated to the soundtrack, that is significant. So when we watched it, we turned off our phones, we turned off all the lights, we drew the curtains, we turned the volume up really loudly so that we could hear this as best as we could in the way that it would maybe be heard in a movie theater.
Yes.
It was on a Sunday afternoon, so our neighbors were not bothered by it. Plus, it's a real quiet movie anyway.
Yeah.
Except for the boom noises.
And the waterfall.
Come along in the waterfall, yeah. The story is this. A woman, played by Tilda Swinton, is in Colombia. She's there working, but she's also tending to a hospitalized sister. And she experiences loud banging noises in her head, which is a real neurological phenomenon known as exploding head syndrome.
Mm.
And she begins a very slow, dreamlike investigation into what this could mean. Why is it happening to her? Who can help her figure it out? Where should she go with this information? Along the way, she meets a man named Hernan, who may or may not be real. Later, she meets another man named Hernan. This one seems to be real. And then he begins talking about how he can remember every single thing that ever happened to him. And then he tells her that she is like a receiver, like an antenna, like a vessel for other people's memories. And then something really weird happens. I won't spoil it. But if you have seen his other films, if you have seen Cemetery of Splendor, and you remember that moment where this thing appears on screen for a moment and then it goes away, and you wondered what it was, and the movie never explains what it was. And if you've seen Uncle Boonmi, who can recall his past lives, and creatures emerge from the Thai jungle in much the same way that they emerge from the Thai jungle in Tropical Malady, you'll know that this is a filmmaker who, A, has no intention of explaining anything to you, and B, wants you to live with the questions.
Yes.
He wants you to live with the mystery of the natural world and the supernatural world. What lies over the edge of life into the other consciousnesses that you may possess?
And the tangibility of the past.
Yes. There is, in all of his films, there are incorporated historical, political trauma. There's always somebody in the military popping up in one of these movies, including right. This one.
Yeah.
Buddhist philosophy. Again, explorations of memory and dream logic. Ideas about that amorphous space between, you know, living and dying. They are not movies to solve or to...
Easter egg
or to get as much as they are to experience. And you can walk out of this movie thinking you saw one thing and turn to the person you went with, and they might tell you that they saw something else.
And you'd both be right.
And you might both be right, or you might both be really dumb.
Also a possibility. Let's never leave that out.
Speaking of movies I want to see again, I want to see this one again.
Oh, yeah.
In the way that I want to see all of his films again and again and again. Like, I finish a film from him and I think, give me a year, I'll come back. And I'm going to look at this again. I'm in the mood to get back in with the Syndromes in a Century, because it's the most, for me, the most challenging so far of his films. And it's the one that is also the most autobiographical, because it's about
his parents.
His parents, yeah.
Yeah, that was the first one I saw, and it didn't do it for me. And yes, maybe now that some time has passed and I've seen some of his other films and liked them, maybe now I'll get what it was about.
But, yeah.
But yeah, for me, it was Uncle Boonmee, where I was like, okay, this guy.
Yeah.
Speaking of legends of international cinema, Film Movement Plus, a streaming service for fans of independent film, opens a world of award-winning entertainment, including some of the best movies from prestigious festivals around the globe. Among the hundreds of titles waiting for you to discover are acclaimed films you won't find anywhere else, plus newly restored classics and award-winning shorts, with new films added every week. Available on all your favorite devices, including Roku, Apple TV, and Amazon Fire, Film Movement Plus is priced at $5.99 a month. But Linoleum Knife listeners can get a 14-day free trial.
I'm so delighted by this.
This is a deal for us. Linoleum Knife listeners can get a 14-day free trial plus 50% off their first 3 paid months using the promo code KNIFE. So sign up today at filmmovementplus.com, promo code KNIFE.
Let's talk about Nightmare Alley.
Sure.
The 1947 Nightmare Alley.
Yes.
I tell you, I didn't know much or really anything about it mm-hmm. until a few years ago, the Cinematheque showed it.
Yes.
And at that time, a couple of essays about the film popped up on the internet. And I thought, oh, this is something I've missed. Let's go.
I've talked about before about how, like, part of how I got into movies as a kid was my older brother had these books about classic Hollywood cinema that he had brought back from college with him. And one of them was this, like, 50 great films book.
Yeah.
And Nightmare Alley was one of them.
Yeah.
And I remember reading about it thinking, oh, this sounds like dark and weird. And then it was one of those movies that I think had a period where it was sort of pulled from distribution. And so, like, it never came on TV or whatever. So I didn't see it until well into adulthood.
Yeah.
But I knew it existed, and you know, it was a film. It was always sort of notorious. It was like, you know, Tyrone Power really fought to make it. Fox didn't really want to do it because they thought it would mess with his kind of clean cut image, but he really wanted to go out on a limb and do this thing. And
it messed with his clean cut image.
Which I'm sure is exactly what he wanted. It was great to see it on the big screen when we went.
Based on the novel by William Lindsay Gresham.
Yes.
And directed by Edmund Golding. Mm-hmm. It is a harrowing film. You know, the production code of the 40s meant that you could suggest.
Yes.
But not show. And this is a really harsh story about people who will, it's about desperate people who will do anything to get by, to get ahead, to survive. And they're all, you know, carnival workers. They're all,
Sideshow
people, con men, you know, mentalists,
yeah.
Stuff like that.
Hucksters.
So what you get out of the original film in all of its, you know, brooding
seaminess.
Brooding black and white, yeah, as you said, seaminess, is this unpleasant picture of, you know, America between World War I and World War II, set during the Depression. And so there's this really unflinching story of people who are doomed. So, of course, it's a perfect noir.
Yes.
For the late 40s. So now, and basically, the short version here is we love this movie.
The 1947.
The 1947 version.
And you can watch that on the Criterion Channel.
It is on the Criterion Channel right now. If you have any plans to see the new version by Guillermo del Toro, and you have not yet seen the original, watch the Guillermo del Toro version first. Because as many things as there are in this film that I like and admire, you can't
top the first
one. You can't top the first one.
Yeah. At least this doesn't.
You have a much less charitable opinion of this than I do.
Yeah.
So why don't you start? Why don't you talk about what it's about?
Sure. So Bradley Cooper plays a guy who, at the first time we see him in the film, he is putting a body under the floorboards of an old house and setting the house on fire and walking away, hopping on a bus, riding it to the end of the line. At the end of the line, there's a carnival.
Yeah.
And he ingratiates himself with the carnival folk and very soon is among them, working there. You know, there's a mentalist played by Toni Collette and her alcoholic husband, David Strathairn. And years earlier, they had a much classier act where they would use these complicated verbal signals. So he'd be blindfolded and she'd say, like, you know, what am I holding in my hand? But the way that she would ask it would let him know what it was. And, oh, it's a watch. It's gold. It's engraved. It's, you know.
Yeah.
And they teach him that act. And he winds up running off himself and starting it with Rooney Mara, who is a woman that he meets in the carnival.
She's the electric lady.
That's right. And, you know, they leave after a whoopsie where Bradley Cooper gives David Strathairn a bottle of wood alcohol rather than the drinking alcohol.
Is it a whoopsie?
Well,
is it a whoopsie?
Look, maybe
was
don't
it a whoopsie in the first film?
Maybe don't store your wood alcohol next to the drinking alcohol, or put them in different bottles or something. In any event, off they go, and they're playing the better supper clubs. And it's all very above board, until they meet Cate Blanchett as a wealthy and powerful psychiatrist who works with wealthy and powerful people, who it turns out has maybe an even worse moral compass than Bradley Cooper does.
Yes.
They decide to go into business together to fleece her clients, but Bradley Cooper starts getting high on his own supply and believing in his own invincibility, and before the fall, after pride cometh the fall.
Thank you for not giving away stuff.
Yeah.
Because what this film, I think, retains is that slow spiral of decisions that you make that sometimes don't feel like decisions.
Right.
There's this opportunity in front of you, and life has already sucked it out of you. So why not? You're going to take what's in front of you.
Yeah.
And I know that you were not fond of Bradley Cooper's performance.
Yes.
As this character, but I differ with you. Why don't we talk about that?
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like Bradley Cooper is playing a con artist in the way that he is constantly playing a con artist. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way that con artists work is by not letting you catch them acting.
Right.
And I was never not watching Bradley Cooper acting in this movie.
Now, I had the misfortune of having to help you edit your review for the rap.
Oh, thank you.
And by misfortune, I mean I encountered your opinion of this performance
before you could see it yourself.
Before I could see it myself. And when I watched it myself, I thought, I don't think I agree with what you're talking about.
Okay.
I think that his performance is pretty, you know, calibrated to show you his descent. And when he is acting for the people, when he is conning the people, it is a heightened persona. But it seems to me like it's in keeping with the way that those kinds of, you know, performers would have behaved back then for an audience.
I don't know. Again, maybe if I hadn't seen Tyrone Power do it first, who I think is a much... He's
a much more somber throughout.
I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Old example, Tyrone Power. Current example, Simon Rex in Red Rocket.
Okay.
Simon Rex in Red Rocket is playing a character who is constantly manipulating everybody who comes in front of him.
Yes.
But he never tips his hat to the audience of like, check me out. He's just doing it. And he's doing it in that smooth way, and you understand why the other people in the film respond to it when they respond to it, or call him on it when they call him on it. But it's never this, like, there's never that extra level of, like, check me out, I am being manipulative right now. He's just oozing it the whole time. And I think that's a much better performance of this kind of, you know, narcissist con artist than what Cooper's doing.
I think that this character, the character of Stan, is a little further down the stony end than Simon Rex's character in Red
Mikey
Rocket.
Mikey Saber.
When we are watching Red Rocket and we see Mikey Saber spinning around in life, he is still in the middle of being high on his own supply. He is still in the middle of, you know, chasing it. I think this character, I think the character of Stan, is halfway to broken down when we get him and has a brief moment of, wait, there might be a way to claw myself out of this, especially when he meets up with the psychologist, the Cate Blanchett character. Mm-hmm. He thinks he's going to get somewhere with the Rooney Mara character, marrying her and you know, dollar signs in his eyes with what they could do together. But soon after that, he realizes that she's not, you know, she's only willing to go halfway.
Right.
And when he meets Cate Blanchett, he sees the next rung up that he might survive with her. Then maybe not. But I think in terms of temperament, this character is already farther down the road of his own demise and is a lot more cynical and hard-bitten and intentional about where he's going. There's an optimism to the character of Mikey Saber in Red Rocket. He believes, you know, he believes that his next phase, he believes that the next phase of his porn career is going to be smooth sailing.
Right.
Right. I don't think that the character of Stan believes that there's a golden road ahead of him.
Oh, I think he does. I don't think he's as self-destructive as you give him credit for being. I think he believes that he's going to pull off this job with Cate Blanchett. He's going to pull off this scam and that it's going to be, you know, it's all going to be good times ahead.
I don't think Mikey in Red Rocket thinks he's running a game. I think he thinks this is just the way life is going to be.
That's possible.
And
yes.
And so I think the character of Stan, being a more cynical creation figure, is always aware of, like, the devil on his back.
Hmm. Arguably. I still have issues with the performance. And
the performance for me is fine throughout.
Okay.
I am, by the end of it, because he is the kind of person, and they tell him this in the beginning of the film, you're easy on the eyes, and he knows that he is,
right?
And so I think Bradley Cooper understands that person, because Bradley Cooper has been told his entire career, you're easy on the eyes. And you know how there are some actors that you can feel their self-regard?
Sure, yes.
I sometimes feel that from Bradley Cooper. This is not a dig on his character or as a human being in real life or anything. But I somehow feel like, you know, he would like a better... I think he would like a career, not a better career. I think he would like a career where he wasn't so darn good looking all the time.
Yeah, he directed A Star Is Born and, like, you know, puts himself through the mill in that one.
Right. So I think that he is going for here is something that is more hard bitten than what he's usually given to do. Not counting A Star Is Born, which is, I'm sure, gave him a taste of, this is what, you know,
acting.
This is what seriousness can do. I like his performance, and I like a whole lot about this film. It looks stunning.
No argument there. It is, you know, Guillermo del Toro knows how to create a world and, like, art direct it, and, you know, the neon of the carnival and the nightclubs and the psychiatrist's office, all, like, curvy Art Deco wood and whatnot. You know, yeah, absolutely. Visually, this movie is a feast, but that's kind of where it ends with me.
And Cate Blanchett can do no wrong.
She can, and she does a lot of wrong this Christmas season. Actually, she's quite bad in Don't Look Up.
I have not seen Don't Look Up yet,
and she's quite bad here. I think here.
Do you think so?
She is doing a series of, like, film noir poses. It's like,
I know.
It's like
I'm so happy.
If RuPaul's Drag Race had, like, Noir Week, like Femme Fatale Week, you would be getting the level of what she's doing here, which is, like, all external, all referential. There's nothing to this performance.
I could not.
It's all, look at me, I can hold a cigarette just so. And she can. But that's it.
Shut up. No.
I'm right.
I'm not going to give away my favorite line reading in this film, because it comes from Cate Blanchett, and it comes near the end of the movie after some stuff has gone down. I think you'll know it when it comes. I love her so much, and I don't think that she can do no wrong. Obviously, if you're telling me about Don't Look Up here, and I have no choice but to currently believe you.
I do love, I want to share Louis Vertel's tweet on this subject.
All right. You're all going to gang up on me now.
No, come on, bring it on.
He's not necessarily, I can take it.
He's not necessarily agreeing with me. In fact, if anything, I think maybe splits the difference between the two of us.
All right.
He says, in my opinion, Cate Blanchett did not need to be on set for Nightmare Alley. Surely by now we have a hologram of her in a skirt suit, raising a cigarette and purring, is that so?
And that's beautiful to me. And I can't get enough of it. And you know what? If it is shallow and empty and referential, she's perfect at this. So, I generally like this film.
I generally did not.
And I will also tell you that it doesn't hold a candle to the original.
There we absolutely agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. If you do insist on seeing this one, watch it first, because if you watch the original first, this one does not hold a candle to it.
Okay. I have not seen Spider-Man. What's the full name of the Spider-Man movie?
Spider-Man No Way Home.
No Way Home. I have not seen it. You saw it at a press screening.
I did.
At which you did not get Omicron variant.
Correct. Yes.
I worry about all the jumping up and down kids that I keep seeing in these videos.
Yes.
In packed auditoriums not wearing masks.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to get a Spider-Man spike.
I keep thinking about a Spider-Man spike.
And pause. And I am concerned about that.
But
you saw the movie and you liked it.
I did.
Quite a bit.
To review this movie at this point almost...
And when it streams, I will like it too.
Sure. Almost feels extraneous because Spider-Man in its first weekend became the highest grossing film of 2021.
And
2020.
That's right.
So, like, everybody has already been running out to see this movie. I am not going to give spoilers, of which there are many.
But you do a spoiler, you do two reviews on Breakfast All Day.
Last week we did a
straightforward review with no spoilers.
Yes, and then today we drop the spoilers discussion.
So you're not going to do any spoilers here.
Correct.
Now, for me, the existence of this movie up until 2 weeks ago was a spoiler.
Well, you...
Because you said you had to go to a press screening, and I said, of what? You said Spider-Man, and I said, which one? And you said, Spider-Man, No Way Home. And I said, I didn't know there was a new Spider-Man movie. And I did not. Oh, but now I do.
Oh, my little lamb.
And I'm very happy about that because I like the Spider-Man movie.
So, yeah. Well, this one basically picked up where the last one left off. Where the world learns that Peter Parker is Spider-Man.
Yes.
That causes quite a few complications in his life. And, in fact... So much so that it's not only impacting his life, but also those of his closest friends, MJ and Ned. The three of them are all turned down for MIT because of their connections to Spider-Man and the recent the stuff that happened at the end of the last movie, which Mysterio tried to blame on Spider-Man, even though it's not his fault. And so Peter Parker feels terrible about this, and he goes to his pal Doctor Strange and says, hey, can you maybe cast a spell that would make everyone in the world forget that Peter Parker is Spider-Man? And Doctor Strange is like, can do. And Wong is like, don't do it. And Strange is like, I got this. And so they cast the spell. But as he's casting it, Peter keeps asking for amendments. Like, oh, well, could maybe MJ remember? And maybe Ned. And, oh, I really don't want to tell Aunt May again. And anyway, things go kerflooey. And it opens up a portal where... Everyone from every possible universe who knows that Peter Parker is Spider-Man shows up, which means Alfred Molina's Dr. Octopus shows up. And
his name is Dr. Octopus?
Yes. Doc Ock. Yes.
Doc Ock.
Willem Dafoe's Green Goblin shows up.
I have already known there was a character named Dr. Octopus somewhere?
Yes.
Okay. Did I just forget?
You probably did.
All right.
Jamie Foxx's Electro and Thomas Hayden Church's Sandman. And, oh, complications ensue.
Yep.
I will get into what complications exactly, but sending them back becomes complicated when they realize that they've all been plucked away from their respective worlds at the moment of their death, directly or indirectly by Spider-Man's hand. I guess indirectly. Spider-Man doesn't kill anybody. And Aunt May is like, well, what if we didn't do that? And what if we could send them back not evil? And then more complications ensue. this is a really entertaining film, both in the big splashy superhero sense, but also I think the Spider-Man movies work in a way that a lot of other superhero movies don't, is that they are teen movies. They are about teen characters dealing with teen things like getting into college and, you know, who gets to be called your best friend. You know, Peter Parker is not a millionaire industrialist, and he's not a Norse god, and he's not an alien. He's a high schooler from Queens. And most of the issues that he has to deal with in the best of these movies is about being a high schooler and that stuff. So I love the scenes with MJ. Tom Holland and Zendaya have great chemistry, and he and Jacob Batalon, who plays Ned. So on that sort of human level, the movie is very engaging, and you really care about how this is going to go, and that kind of helps anchor things once things get wild and weird and multiversal and all the stuff that happens. I think also for people who had an issue with the Tom Holland movies because they've been breezier versions of Peter Parker, you know, this is not the character.
Yeah, we can't have that.
This is not the character who is haunted by tragedy and coping with economic realities, nothing like that.
Right.
They move move in a darker direction by the time this thing is over.
Well, and, it's time. He's grown.
And they do it in a way that feels organic to these films and that I think bodes well for whatever it is they're going to do next. So, yeah.
About time that kid learned what life was like.
Basically, yes. So I'm going to leave it at that. But I liked this quite a bit.
I believe you. I believe I will like it too.
I think you will.
And when it streams and we sit down on the couch to watch it, you can tell me all the things that I don't understand.
I'll be happy to do
that. Since I never I don't retain.
No.
From Marvel to Marvel. I don't. And I don't think I should have to. I feel like I should, everything should be, it should be like old-timey sitcoms where things just stop and they begin and they end and then I don't have to remember what happened the next time around.
You know, or just give me a good previously on. That's all I ask.
That would be very helpful.
Yeah.
But that's what I have here, you here for. Would you like me to read a 5-star review?
I would.
Before we eat dinner?
Yes. Because whenever people leave us a 5-star review, we happily read it on the What's for dinner?
Remember that white bean cacio e pepe I made the other night?
I do.
Guess what there is left over?
White bean cacio e pepe?
Well, there's no cacio or pepe in it yet. I have to put that in after I reheat the white beans. That's how you make it, you know.
White bean cacio e pepe.
But we're going to have that.
All right, then.
I don't even want to read this 5-star review. I want to go make that food right now and eat it.
Read that review, then you can make the food.
It's Christmas. I should get what I want.
I want you to read the 5-star review.
This is from WW Girl.
Okay.
Or Wawa Girl.
Wonder Woman.
And I don't know how to say your name, but I do like it if you would call yourself Wawa Girl. It's just more fun.
And what does this listener have to say?
Well, Wawa Girl says, listening to this podcast has made me a better viewer of movies.
Oh.
Hearing David and Alonzo's analysis has made me a more critical and appreciative viewer of film. Not to mention that they have the best witty banter and are couple goals, as the kids say. I found this podcast a while ago when What the Flick ended, which still saddens me, and I have no clue who canceled that show, for what reason. Well, I know all the reasons and who did it, but you know what? It doesn't matter anymore, because...
I do hope you found Breakfast All Day.
Have you heard the good news about Breakfast All Day? It's a YouTube show and podcast starring Alonzo Duralde and Christy Lemire. And Matt Atchity, who is currently on sabbatical / hiatus, and annually, Ben Mankiewicz deigns to bob his head in there.
He's got a lot on his plate.
He's a very busy man. Just turn on Turner Classic Movies. You'll see him being very busy.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, continuing with this 5-star review from... Whoa, girl.
You just like saying it.
I do love saying it now. But the one good thing that came out of this cancellation, out of that cancellation, is that it led me to this podcast.
Oh.
It's a testament to David Alonso's humor, intelligence, and charm. That they've built a sustained and loyal fan base for all these years.
Well, thank you very much. That was lovely.
I'm reading these reviews now without feeling ashamed of myself.
Good.
Without feeling like I don't deserve it.
Yes.
That's my goal now.
Yes.
And I'm
own it.
I am at this point, I'm 22% successful.
All right.
Internally.
Well, we're building.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Well, thank you, WW Girl. Yes, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We will absolutely read it on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Spotify, Google Play, Amazon Music, CastBox, Podbean, etc., etc., etc. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Follow him and his exploits and buy his stuff at blue.bandcamp.com. This is our last regular linoleum knife.
This is the last linoleum knife of 2021.
Wow.
It is December 22nd.
Yes.
It is 5:51 p.m.
Yes.
Pacific Standard Time.
We will have other stuff coming your way.
Yes, January 3rd, we will resume recording Linoleum Knife. So we're gone for about 10 days.
Yes. But in the meantime...
you're going to get all the other podcasts that we do in the extended Linoleum verse that comes to you via Patreon.
Yes.
You're going to get an episode of Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, where we talk about an old movie. It's a surprise which one. You're going to get an episode of LKTV with a very special guest who joined us to talk about the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yes.
You're going to get an episode of Linoleum Knife and Fork that we may pop up and record after Christmas so we can just talk about how Christmas dinner went.
Why not? People are dining up at that porchetta.
But there's a whole bunch of other topics that we have to describe for you. And you're going to get a special episode of Linoleum Nights, which is an Ask Us Anything episode. We've been soliciting questions
from our Patreon members.
But everybody's going to get to hear the answers.
Yes.
And that's what's happened. That's what's happening, and that's what's coming over the break while we don't actually record much of anything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So until we meet again, wishing you all a wonderful holiday. Thank you for spending a tumultuous year with us. We hope we've been a little entertaining.
Maybe.
Enlightening. Maybe something.
We were some kind of something.
In this horror show. And, you know, best wishes to us all for a much, much better.
God bless me, everyone.
2022. Happy holidays. Until next time.
Goodbye.